This is Gulf Coast State College, Anatomy and Physiology, the Lymphatic System and Immunity, Part 2. Last time we left off talking about some of the primary lymphatic organs. Now we're going to talk about the secondary lymphatic organs and tissues, beginning with the lymph nodes. And I bet you already know a little bit about these. Think about the last time maybe you had a sore throat or whatever, and you went to mommy, and mommy checked you out, and she felt your neck, and she felt these lumps in your neck, and she said, "Oh, you've got swollen glands." Well, what she really meant to say was you have swollen lymph nodes. So you already kind of know a little bit about these. Yeah, they're roughly bean-shaped organs, usually less than an inch in size. Remember, they're located along lymphatic vessels, lymph vessel into a lymph node and lymph vessel out of a lymph node. What are the two major functions? Well, the first function, I think of like a physical function. Physically, the lymph nodes filter debris, junk, crud, microbes from lymph. Lymph nodes filter lymph. And that's easy for my pea brain to remember. So just think of it kind of like a brush or a comb, you know, filtering out dandruff or whatever from your hair. Same general idea. Second major function is more of a biochemical kind of a function. Lymph nodes are one of the places where immune responses are performed by B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes. Remember that B cells and T cells are the two main types of lymphocytes. So these lymph nodes are one of the places where we station the mature Bs and the mature Ts to fight the fight against infection and against cancer. Your book says, I think there's roughly 600 or so lymph nodes scattered about the body. The only important point there is they're everywhere, and that's great because they can fight off the foreign invaders pretty much anywhere we may encounter them. But let's get organized. I only want you to know three major groupings or clusters of lymph nodes. There's those lymph nodes we just talked about that mommy felt in your neck, and they're called cervical lymph nodes. And you know the root word for the neck, if you study the vertebrae, is cervical. Then we have another group of lymph nodes that's clustered in the armpit region. Remember, the root word for armpit is axilla. So these lymph nodes are called the axillary lymph nodes. I hope you remember that. You'll need that in your training. If you're asked to check an axillary temperature, I hope you shove the thermometer in the armpit. Then there are the inguinal lymph nodes. They're down here. I like the name because it sounds like, and it means, the in the groin lymph nodes. And you're thinking, well, that's easy, only three groups of lymph nodes to remember. But here's how I ask the question on a test. I just want you to take things a step further. You need to know that infections tend to spread through our lymphatic system. Cancers also spread or metastasize often through our lymphatic vasculature. So here's a great question. Your patient has a malignant melanoma of the left foot. Which group of lymph nodes will the cancer most likely spread to first? I hope you would all pick the inguinal lymph nodes because they're the closest ones, and that's where they will spread to first. Another example, your patient has breast cancer. Where will the cancer most likely spread to first? And I hope you all pick the axillary lymph nodes. As a matter of fact, breast cancer will often first show up as a swollen lymph node towards the armpit. It's hard to feel breast cancer on a self-exam at home in the breast tissue because there's so much fatty tissue there. So those lymph nodes in the armpit region will often be the first sign. So you get the idea. Let's take it a step further. Let's say your patient has breast cancer. They have a breast removed, and also since the cancer has spread to the axillary lymph nodes, they had to take out the lymph nodes out of this armpit, and there's a note on the chart that says no sticks and no blood pressure in that arm, please. And then you go in that day, and two people quit. One's on vacation, one's on a break. Typical day on the floors, by the way, as a nurse. And you're going really fast, so you don't see that sign on the chart or the sign that's over the headboard. So you quickly go in there, and you even forget to use alcohol, and you just stick a needle in the arm where the lymph nodes have been removed. Did you just make a big mistake? Yeah, you made a huge mistake because, well, number one, you didn't use alcohol. Number two, there's no lymph nodes in that arm. So guess what they can't fight off so well anymore? Infection. So you put them at a huge risk of getting a really bad infection in that arm that they can't fight any longer. Also, why does the chart say no blood pressure in that arm? Well, you'll notice in the patients who have breast cancer with the lymph nodes removed, that arm looks swollen and edematous. It is because we've interrupted, we've damaged, we've scarred that drainage of flow through that arm, and the arm will swell up. So you don't want to put a blood pressure cuff, that's like a tourniquet, around an arm that's already swollen, already having trouble draining the lymph. You're only going to make matters worse. And again, if you do make this mistake, trust me, the patient knows that this note is on the chart. The family knows the note's on the chart. And there's always a lawyer in the family, and things go downhill from there. This is just a cool gross anatomy picture. I love looking at gross anatomy. I hope you do too. Here's from a cadaver. Here's a lymph node. Notice a couple things. Lymph vessel into a lymph node and lymph vessels out of a lymph node. And another big picture point, hey, there's the veins kind of going with the lymph vessels. Let's dive into a little bit more detail on the lymph node. We're going to look at some histology that you checked out in lab. In general, organs, a lot of organs are broken down into two major groups. One is called the stroma. The stroma, you can think of as the framework of the organ. I think of it a different way because I have a pea brain. I think of the stroma like the struts. Like struts hold stuff up and stroma holds stuff up. So the stroma is the struts. What's the stroma of this organ and some other organs in anatomy as well? First, we have this shown in green, the connective tissue collagen capsule that is part of the supportive structure. Then we have these trabecular beams, these beams of collagen connective tissue that dive into the organ from the capsule and in this case just partially separate the organ. And finally, something else. Poking off the trabeculae, we have these hair-like fibers that you studied in histology called reticular fibers. Reti, the root word, means network, and it's a network of fine connective tissue fibers that physically do the trapping of the debris, again, like bristles on your hairbrush do. Then the other major part of many organs is called the parenchyma. This is the functioning part of the meat. I think of it like the parenchyma is where the party starts. And most organs have that divided into two regions we already talked about. The outer meat is called the cortex. The inner meat is called the medulla. So let's get to the nitty-gritty. Over to your left is a histological preparation of a lymph node. Should be reviewed from lab. We have a connective tissue capsule. We have some trabeculae diving in. We've got an outer dark bark called the cortex and an inner light meat called the medulla. Let's look at that in more detail. What's in the cortex of a lymph node? We have these roughly round, purple, ball-shaped structures called either lymphatic follicles or you may call them lymphatic nodules. They are synonyms. They mean the exact same thing. I don't care what you call them. What's inside there? Mostly lymphocytes. After all, this is a lymphatic organ and it's got lymphocytes. That's how it got its name. For our studying pleasure, however, someone has broken down the lymphatic nodules into two types. There's a primary type and a secondary type. The primary type, I guess we can use this one as an example. It's kind of a solid ball of purple cells sitting there in a resting sort of undisturbed state. But then let's say something comes along, like that cruddy, dirty, rusty, bacteria-filled junk that was running up my arm into the chain of lymph nodes in my armpit. And that junk hits a primary nodule, and it says, okay, I'm a lymphatic nodule, I'm supposed to do something, so I'm going to get all juiced up, I'm going to get all activated and turned on, and I'm going to turn into a secondary nodule. Think of that like an activated nodule. And they look different histologically. They develop this inner, lighter, special center like a Tootsie Pop center called a germinal center. And I love that name. Germinate. If a seed germinates, what happens? It's going to grow. And sure enough, we'll learn at the end of this unit that something's going to germinate out of the germinal center. Something you probably heard about before you ever took the course. Called antibodies. That's what's going to come out of there. What about the medulla? That, of course, is the inner region of this organ. Inside the medulla, the lymphocytes are arranged in like strands. So some genius looked at those strands and said, I will call those medullary cords. Here's a big ticket item for the lymph node you got to know. What are all those purple dots, just like we did in the thymus gland? Number one, with triple stars, B cells, mostly B cells inside of a lymph node. Second, very important cells called plasma cells. The plasma cells are the cells that are going to pump out the antibodies. Then, the next three cells are old friends of ours, so you don't have to really memorize anything new. Dendritic cells to grab on to things with their branches and hand them off to the other guys to deal with. Macrophages to Pac-Man down some junk. And T cells, once again, to help carry out our magical immune responses. I want to take a minute here to give you a big picture point while I'm thinking of it. Please write it down. There are both B cells and T cells in all of the lymphatic organs and tissues except one. And that one is the thymus gland. Just remember, thymus gland with a T, T cell with a T. No B cells in the thymus gland. We need to understand a little bit of the physiology of the lymph node. So this is one of those flow kind of a slides. Students sometimes don't like the flow questions on the test, but as instructors, we like them. Because if you know the parts and you know the right order, it tells us you know both some anatomy and physiology. So here we go. Let's trace the flow of lymph through the lymph node in the one-way direction that it goes. Start over here to your left with some vessels called afferent lymphatic vessels. Afferent means to carry towards. We're carrying lymph towards a lymph node. The way I remember it, though, is A for afferent, A for approach. Then the fluid percolates in a little space under the capsule. The name for a space in general is a sinus, and this space is called the subcapsular sinus because it's the below the capsule space. From there, the fluid percolates in spaces around the trabeculae called trabecular sinuses. And you got a picture while it's percolating through there that physically the gunk is getting filtered by the bristles of the brush, so to speak. The reticular fibers are snatching that crud and bacteria out of the lymph and slowly but surely cleaning it. Then the fluid percolates next in some spaces in the medulla that some genius called the medullary sinus. And again, picture it all happening. As the fluid's percolating through, physically getting cleaned, it's also biochemically getting cleaned by all those cells we just talked about as well. Then finally, the fluid exits the lymph node through vessels called efferent lymphatic vessels. The root word efferent means to carry away, but my pea brain just remembers E for efferent and E for exit. So hopefully what happens is we get the dirty fluid coming one end of the bean and clean fluid coming out the other end of the bean. As a matter of fact, I think a lymph node's like many bean washing machines, and that general principle will get you pretty far, actually. One more bit of anatomy here. It's anatomy 101. Here's a dimple or a depression in this organ called the lymph node. You may have already seen it in a lung. You'll see it in the spleen and in ovaries. It's very common. The name for this is called a hilum, H-I-L-U-M. This is an area where things go in and out of organs, often like vessels or nerves. You'll see that as a recurrent theme in anatomy. We're ready to move on to the spleen, another one of our secondary organs. It is the single largest lymphatic organ in the body, if anybody asks you. That sounds like a test question. I'm not saying it is, but if it was, that should be a give me on the test. Location, on the left side of your body between the stomach and the diaphragm. You got to know where it's located. Half the battle in anatomy and taking care of patients is just knowing where the parts are. It has a stroma. It has a hilum. All I want you to write down there is pretty much same as lymph node, and you'll have it right. But take a look at the picture of the spleen. Big purpley red thing, that's significant, about the size of your fist. Notice the hilum. Red artery in, blue vein out. The spleen does not filter lymph. Lymph nodes filter lymph. By looking at this picture, you should be able to tell me what the spleen filters. I mean, splenic artery in, splenic vein out. Take a wild guess. And you got it. The spleen filters blood. Let's talk about more functions of the spleen, broken down here on this slide. Yes, look at the spleen. It's big and red and purpley. And that leads to one of its functions. It stores blood. As a matter of fact, your book says, at any one given time, it stores up to one-third of the body's platelets. Kind of amazing to think about that. The spleen is therefore often referred to as a blood reservoir. It's kind of like, almost like a half a pint of blood or whatever, sitting there just ready to be used. And I'll give you an example of what a surgical attending did many, many years ago, decades ago, and it wasn't around here, to demonstrate the function of the spleen as a blood reservoir. A patient injured their spleen. During the operation, he took the spleen out. He laid it on the tray next to the patient. Unknown to me, what he did to all the med students to kind of freak them out, he took a syringe of epinephrine out of his pocket while I wasn't looking. He injected it into the spleen, and the adrenaline made all the blood vessels in the spleen contract. And when the spleen contracted up to like the size of a prune, it instantly squirted all the blood out of the blood vessels. Now, it was cool to look at, but you couldn't get away with doing that today, obviously with all the blood and body fluid precautions. But he demonstrated to me that the blood reservoir function of the spleen was a real one. And so when we get injured, when your patients get injured and they're losing blood, it's kind of like your spleen can give you a mini automatic, very quick transfusion because adrenaline is high at that time. The spleen scrunches down and gives you a little injection of blood. Since the spleen is a bag of blood, I want to do another mini critical thinking question here. If the spleen does get nicked, what is the implication of that? What's the danger of that? Well, the danger is the patient could bleed out through that bag of blood. It's like popping a water balloon full of blood. So that's why when we had patients with an injured spleen, we took them out. These days, I understand there's advanced surgery for minor lacerations, but in general, when the spleen is nicked, we took it out to save their life. And the spleen is the most commonly injured intra-abdominal organ, say like in car accidents, motorcycle accidents, and so forth. Second major function of the spleen, well, hey, it's part of the immune system. We got both B cells and T cells there, and yeah, this is where we will have immune responses. This is where we will fight the fight against foreign invaders, specifically ones that get in our blood. Third function, there's Pac-Man cells in the spleen, and those Pac-Man cells will munch down on bacteria. And look what else is there. They will also clean out any worn out or dead and dying blood cells and platelets. You might recall that red blood cells live about 120 days, and then they start to kind of fall apart. If we didn't have a way to get rid of all those fragments, they would clog up our kidneys and cause us harm. We have to get a way or have a way to clean up the dead and dying blood cells, and the spleen is one of the organs that does it. So these are the three major functions of the spleen. While you're thinking about that or maybe writing some notes down, I want to ask you a mini critical thinking question that I can absolutely ask you on the test. If a patient has their spleen taken out, what are they at higher risk for the rest of their life? Answer, of course, infection. Look, you took out one of their immune organs, one of their lymphatic organs. Higher risk of infection their whole life. As a matter of fact, when we took a spleen out in someone, we automatically gave them a vaccination. I think they still do that today because they are at higher risk for, I think, more specifically, gram-positive infections. Also, interestingly, your sickle cell disease patients, what happens in them is their red blood cells, they're not round. They become elongated in a sickle shape, and that tends to plug up the small arterioles in the spleen. Often they present to the emergency room with abdominal pain. Usually that's because they're killing off parts of their body because the red blood cells are clogging off capillaries and clogging off the blood supply and oxygen supply. And many sickle cell patients kill off their own spleen and don't even know it. And the spleen ends up at autopsy. They find like a little nub in a scar tissue. So your sickle cell patients, you have to watch them for infection their whole life for the same reason. As far as structure of the spleen, kind of the odd man out. Yeah, it has a stroma. Yeah, it has a parenchyma. But the parenchyma is a little bit different. The parenchyma is broken down in the spleen into two basic parts. Number one, shown here as these purple, circular-looking things that kind of look like pepperonis on a pizza. That's called the white pulp. Why is it called the white pulp? It sure ain't white. It's purple on all your tissue slides. It's called white pulp because it's mostly white blood cells, lymphocytes, and macrophages, all arranged around a little artery in the middle that some genius called the central artery. On this histological prep, there's the other kind of division of the parenchyma of the spleen. It's called the red pulp. Why is it called red pulp? First of all, pulp, I should tell you, pulp just means junk, like the pulp in orange juice, just the junk. Why is it called red pulp? Because it's mostly red blood cells. For your studying pleasure, someone divided the red pulp into two parts, splenic cords and venous sinuses. But all it says on this slide is those things are composed of or filled with blood. Red pulp is mostly just red blood cells. This is a beautiful slide. I know it's only a drawing, but I love it. This is where I put the anatomy and physiology together. I picture it all happening. I want you to try to do that too. Be the spleen. Check it out. Here's the capsule. Here's some trabeculae. Here's splenic artery coming in, splenic vein coming out. Let's picture the spleen at work. Here comes in some dirty blood through the artery. Then that artery branches into hundreds and hundreds of smaller arteries called central arteries. Recall they are surrounded by cuffs, by sleeves in three dimensions. It'd be like a pepperoni or whatever, surrounding the central artery. And these are all the B cells and the T cells and the macrophages. It just so turns out these arteries are very leaky and the blood leaks out of them into the cuff of white pulp, and the white pulp does its magic. The B cells and T cells do their immune dance, their immune responses, the macrophages do their munching, and slowly but surely clean the blood that kind of filtered out of those arteries. Then the blood gets out of the white pulp and just streams into the red pulp in cords called splenic cords, shown here in yellow. It's just blood again. It's the blood that came out. So the blood here called splenic cords, it's got to find its way back into the cardiovascular system, and it does that by entering these dilated, leaky, open venous channels called venous sinuses. And then the blood heads on out of the spleen through the splenic vein, and hopefully it's clean. So be the spleen, picture it all happening. Just to help you maybe on your histology slides in lab, by the way, let me go back to this other slide. For some reason, whenever I look at a spleen, I see a pepperoni pizza, and the white pulp are the pepperonis, and the red pulp is the sauce. I don't know if that'll help you or not, but just a kind of a corny way to remember it. Let's next move on to malt. I love malt. I love saying malt. It sounds cool. It is cool. It reminds me of when I was a kid of malted milkshakes. I don't know where you get those anymore, but I always used to get it when I went to visit my grandma. But what is malt really? Remember from many slides ago, we defined it. It is what and where it says it is. It's mucosa associated lymphatic tissue. In other words, lymphatic nodules with, yes, both B and T cells in mucous membranes, including, for example, respiratory tracts, gastrointestinal, urinary, and reproductive tracts, wherever we have mucous membranes pretty much. And how beautiful is that setup? I mean, think of how those layers are always under assault from all kind of foreign invaders and bacteria and other junk. It's nice to have lymphatic tissue in those areas. Notice I'm saying tissue, by the way, and not organ. These things are not surrounded by capsules. Therefore, they are not organs. That's why we call them tissues. Two examples in the body I'll give you that you may have seen in lab. First, the tonsils. Everyone's heard of their tonsils in the back of their throat. We have five tonsils. You should draw yourself a little picture. The five tonsils are, number one, a single pharyngeal tonsil tucked way back up high here in the back of the throat behind this finger hanging down called the uvula. The pharyngeal tonsil with the star, though, has a more common name. Nobody calls it the pharyngeal tonsil. It is known as the adenoid. Write that down right here. It is the adenoid. Next are the palatine tonsils. They run up here in the soft tissue on the sides of the palate. Then we have two lingual tonsils on the back of the tongue. Lingual refers to language or the tongue. So we have five tonsils, like a ring of fire in the back of your throat. And think how beautiful that is. From the first day you're born onwards, all the things you're drinking, you're eating, you're breathing in, someone next to you on the plane coughing, hacking, sneezing. You go down the salad bar at your favorite restaurant, 100 people bend down the line ahead of you, things falling off their face and their hair into the salad bar, and you're making a nice tossed salad. All that stuff coming past, it's got to get past the ring of fire. So good thing we have the tonsils back there to help prevent or reduce the chance of infection from all that stuff. You might be thinking now, wait a minute. Why then do they take tonsils out in people who have lots of infections? Because that really shouldn't make sense to you. After all, I just said it was the ring of fire protecting you. Why would you go take them out? Here's the best explanation I ever heard. It goes like this. If you were to culture the back of my throat or anybody's throat, would it be sterile? Of course not. All kinds of bacteria, staph, strep, you name it. And most of those are good bacteria. They don't harm us. But in some people, the theory is that the tonsils, for whatever reason, selectively kill off too much of our good strep, which therefore allows the bad strep to overgrow, take over the territory, take over the nutrients. And so if kids get a whole bunch of recurrent strep throats, the doctor says, let's take the tonsils out. And that's why that makes sense. Sometimes they'll take out the tonsils. Sometimes they'll take out the tonsils and the adenoid. You'll see that terminology on the chart. But please know that the adenoid is just another tonsil. It's a little bit tougher to get to. It's a little bit technically harder to get to. The reason they take it out is, well, it's not just to make more money. Of course, that's not the reason. Often in little kitties, that tonsil swells up so much, it blocks the drainage tube that comes from the middle ear. And kitties who get a lot of middle ear infections, they may benefit by having the adenoid removed. So that's why sometimes you'll see on the chart tonsils and adenoid removed. Another example of molds will go down into the small intestine, specifically the ileum. Look here in the area of the mucosa and submucosa of the ileum. We have multiple round balls, nodules of lymphocytes, and they have a specific name that you must know. They are called Peyer's patches. So this is the reason why, for example, everybody who eats an E. coli cheeseburger doesn't necessarily get sick or die. Because if the E. coli even makes it past the epithelial protection, it may encounter these balls of lymphocytes that may kind of nip it in the bud right then and there. Now, I don't recommend testing out the system, but I'm just saying that's why we don't always get sick or die if we eat E. coli cheeseburger. Let me also touch on a term here called lymphoma. It's not a mystery. Oma is a tumor. Lymph refers to lymphocytes. It's a tumor of lymphocytes. You can get them pretty much anywhere you have lymphocytes. You may see them in the ileum. And they call these tumors in general MALT tumors. If that comes back on the chart, your patient has a MALT tumor, I don't want you to freak out. It's not because they drank too many malted milkshakes. It's because they have a tumor of their MALT tissue. Now we are ready to start to talk about immunity. In this unit, we'll talk about non-specific immunity, which is also called innate immunity. They're synonyms. They're both good terms. I like the word non-specific because this part of our immune system is non-specific. It'll go after anything and everything. I like the term innate because that means we're born with it, and we are. The seven types of non-specific immunity we'll look at in order are listed on this slide. I'm not going to read it to you. This is just a laundry list slide. We're going to break them down one at a time in that order. First, what do all these things have in common? All our non-specific immune defenses, number one, we're born with them. Number two, they work very quickly. And number three, they're general. In other words, they'll kind of work against anything and everything, so to speak. I put a picture up here just to maybe bring that home for you. I mean, we're born with lashes and skin and eyebrows and mucous membranes and tears. And all this stuff is quick at the ready to protect us from funguses, bacteria, different kinds of bacteria, staph, strep. That's the basics of non-specific immunity. Let's start with physical and chemical barriers. One day I was sitting back and looking at this big slide, and I was trying to think, how do all these things, you know, how do all these physical things protect us? How can I put it in a nutshell for my simple mind? And, you know, we'll go through this list one at a time, but in general they work by either blocking, trapping, diluting, or flushing. And if you do that to a bacteria, you've obviously kind of disabled it. So that's not in the book, but if it helps you, you can use it. First comes the skin and mucous membranes. And if I ask you, what is the first line of defense against invasion by pathogens? Our first line of defense is the skin and mucous membranes, picking every time on the test. What's a pathogen, in case you don't know, with a star? Well, gen, the root word genesis, means the beginning of or to make or to create. Pathos means disease. So a pathogen is anything that can make a disease. A bacteria, a virus, a fungus, etc. If you don't believe me, wait till you see your first burn victim patients. I picked out from your book pictures of a first, second, and third degree burns. I used to hate to go to the burn unit. Don't like to use the word hate, but I used to hate to go to the burn unit. The sounds, the smells, you'll never forget once you go in there. And obviously it's a terrible type of an injury to have. And one of the things that they will most often succumb to, since they lose their first line of defense, is infection. Another thing I want to add in here and connect to our fluid chapters later, when they lose huge sheets of skin, not only are they prone to invasion by infection, you'll also notice this, you know, that fluids kind of weep or leak out of that area. So the other thing you battle in those patients besides infection is you're going to battle a lot of fluid and electrolyte imbalances as well. So very challenging patients to take care of. What about hair? You're thinking, hair, how does that protect me? Well, wait till you see your chemotherapy patients. What do they lose? Hair, eyebrows, eyelashes. And when I worked as an eye doctor, I saw those patients. And they had many more eye injuries because they'd be walking around outside by a construction site, wind blows something in their eyeball, eyelashes, eyebrows can't trap it. So, yep, they're more prone to infection. What about cilia? What do cilia do? They beat, right? They move, like in your upper respiratory tract, and they move up that mucus up to the back of your throat where you could either swallow it or spit it out, kind of dealer's choice at that point in time. But people who smoke, they get paralyzed, right? So they are higher risk for infection. They also wake up in the morning, don't they, with a big hacking smoker's cough because they don't have that normal steady clearance of mucus going on. What about tears, saliva, mucus? I'm not going to break them down one at a time. But in general, if due to age or drug side effects or diseases, you dry out those membranes, you got it. Those patients are more prone to infection. How about urine? If somebody either involuntarily or voluntarily holds their urine too long, guess what they're higher risk for? Of course, it's infection because you lose the flushing action of the urine. Same thing with vomiting. If someone comes into you as a patient with vomiting and says, doctor, you know, stop the vomiting. Stop it now. Do you automatically slap them with the anti-vomiting drugs? No, not necessarily, because that is ejecting, the pathogens from the body. Same thing with diarrhea. You don't automatically stop all the diarrhea with the anti-diarrhea pills because we are expelling these organisms from our body. We'll talk about chemical protection next. We're born with this as well. Our skin, the fluids on our skin, turns out slightly acid, and acid does tend to kill or inhibit some bacterium. Sebum, or oil on our skin, does inhibit some bacteria. Vaginal secretions, also acidic, kills bacteria. Unfortunately, also harmful to sperm. Gastric juice, strong acid in there. Also special enzymes in there that kill bacteria. Kind of weird. Came out in the news not too long ago. People who took too many antacids, who overdosed on antacids, they neutralized too much acid in their stomach. So guess what happened? They got infections. The weird thing is they got pneumonia. No one ever explained to me why neutralizing stomach acid led to specifically a higher chance of pneumonia infections. But if you Google antacids and pneumonia, you'll get a bunch of hits. Check it out. Then comes one of my favorite things, a chemical called a lysozyme. Love the name. Lyso means to break apart. Zyme means enzyme. And it is an enzyme in many body fluids. It's in saliva, it's in tears, it's in breast milk, it's in your gastrointestinal juices, and it can kill bugs. Okay, what if the bacteria gets past your first line of defense and your physical and chemical barriers? Are you dead yet? No, of course not, because there's six more things on the list. And we have things called phagocytes. You probably already know what those are. Cyte means cell. Phago means to eat. These are our Pac-Man cells. The three Pac-Man cells I want you to know are neutrophils, eosinophils, and the main one are macrophages with six stars. They are the big eaters. If I ask you what does most of the munching in the body, you're going to say macrophages, followed by number two, neutrophils. Eosinophils do a little bit, not a whole lot. You might ask why I put it in there, because I made myself up a little mnemonic. I know you got a lot of stuff to remember in anatomy and physiology. So here's how I do it. If someone is your enemy, there's another name for that. They're called your nemesis. So what's the nemesis of bacteria? Well, phagocytes are. And Nemesis is spelled N-E-M-E-S-I-S. So I just remember N-E-M for Nemesis, and I remember the three types of phagocytes. Phagocytosis just means the process of munching. Nice picture here shown of a phagocyte grabbing onto a yeast cell and going to pull it into itself and gobble it up. This slide here is just off the hook, or as my son would say, this slide is sick. I love this slide. Look at it. Scanning electron micrograph, 3D, in color, almost 2,000 power, showing a phagocyte gobbling up a microbe. Just cool to look at, isn't it? Nothing new on the slide. It's just cool. What about if the pathogen gets past our physical and chemical barriers and past our phagocytes? Are we dead yet? Of course not. We got something else. They're called natural killer cells, and I love these things. They're typically abbreviated NK cells. Write that down. You might see it that way. What are they? They're lymphocytes. Lymphocytes other than B cells or T cells. I guess I told you a little white lie earlier, didn't I? I said B cells and T cells are the two main types of lymphocytes, but they're not the only types. About 5% of our lymphocytes are natural killer cells. We're born with them, ready to kill. They wander throughout your body in a process called immunological surveillance. I love that term. And they wander around looking for bad cells like cancer cells or virus-infected cells, and they just go kill them. Here's a picture down to your lower right of a malignant melanoma, very potentially deadly kind of a skin cancer. Sometimes melanoma spreads. It often goes to the liver. And when it gets to the liver, usually the prognosis is very poor. You might have heard of a patient like this where the doctor said, we've tried everything, all the chemotherapy and so forth, but the tumor's progressing, your liver's full of it, it's spreading, you only have 2 months to live. And then, did you ever hear that maybe that patient went on to live 5 years, 10 years, or longer? Well, possibly. One of the reasons is the natural killer cells in the body got jacked up enough finally on their own to get the upper hand on things and heal the patient. I know there's another explanation as well. It's not part of this course, but yes, there are other reasons why people miraculously may overcome an illness. But you know, you're not just taking this course to get an A. You're trying to help people. So someone who took A&P said, hey, wait a minute. If I know this, then I can maybe help cure some people. And sure enough, people have experimented with ways to take natural killer cells, to make them multiply in the lab, which is a hard thing to do, very complicated. But you get a whole bunch of them, and then you re-inject them back into patients. And sure enough, some diseases, like malignant melanoma, people have tried to treat by shooting into or injecting into patients to hopefully help them or cure them. Then we have interferons. I love the term interferons. Interferons sounds like interference. And interferons do run kind of an interference pattern, if you're a football fan, so to speak. What are interferons? Don't let this be a mystery. This is a very important chemical in the body. These are proteins produced by viral infected cells. That do what? Check it out. They protect non-infected cells by preventing viral replication. Here's the deal. If a virus particle just gets into a cell, that's not really where the damage occurs. The damage occurs if the virus infects the cell. Infects means duplicates or replicates. Once the virus starts to duplicate within you, that's what's going to harm you or kill you. So this is a beautiful substance to have. Down below on this slide, I put a picture of a liver, just for an example. Let's say there's an infected cell in the liver. And what I usually draw on the board is I draw a cell with a sad face on it. And inside the cell, I put like what looks like little chicken pox marks. That represents that the virus has already infected that cell. That cell, that viral infected cell, knows it's toast. It's gone, it's dead, or it's harmed. But it says, wait a minute, I might be dead, but I want to protect my next door neighbor over here who's not infected. So as a last ditch effort before he dies, he squirts over a little juice, a little interferon, typically abbreviated, by the way, IFN, shoots that little special juice over on the non-infected guy, and what does it do? It protects him. How? Does it prevent the virus particle from getting in him? No. One little dot could get in him. I usually draw a new cell as a happy face. I put one little chicken pox mark in them on the board. But what does interferon do? It prevents that virus from duplicating. And if we could prevent the replication, we could save that other cell. You will use this in real life. This is real stuff. You know, in the hospital, we observe body and blood fluid precautions to protect ourselves from many things. I know you're thinking things like STD, like HIV, and so forth. But one of the biggest worries in the hospital as a healthcare provider is actually hepatitis C. It's another reason I put the liver in here. A lot of people get hepatitis C. It's hard to detect. It's hard to diagnose. A lot of people are carriers and they don't even know they have it. So it's easily spread. I mean, if I have hepatitis C and I rub my mouth or whatever during class because I'm drooling, and then I leave the classroom and I open the doorknob, and then you come after me and touch the doorknob and then rub your eye or some other mucous membrane, theoretically possible you get hepatitis C that way. They say viral particles like hepatitis C can live maybe up to a month on like a doorknob. That's why they say, you know, don't share toothbrushes with someone with hepatitis C. And in the old days, we had no treatment. Some of those patients would get really sick. Some would go on to liver failure. A small percentage of them would go on to die. And we didn't do anything. We didn't know how. Then finally, someone who took this course said, now, wait a minute. What about that stuff called interferon? Maybe that'll work. And sure enough, they now have tried, actually for a number of years, have used interferon injections for hepatitis C patients, and they do much better. This is real stuff. It's real life. And you'll probably inject somebody with it if you go into healthcare. It's also used in MS. Multiple sclerosis, some people think, is caused by a virus called human herpes virus 6. There's all kinds of herpes. And interferon has been injected in multiple sclerosis patients with some success as well. The next non-specific immune defense I want to talk about is called the complement system. Please make this easier than it is. Do not overthink or overanalyze this on my test. I know the slides look busy, but I'm going to boil it down to just a few bullet points you need to know. Number one, what is this stuff? It's proteins, a series of proteins that you're born with in the blood that can jack up our immune responses. When you activate them, when you irritate them, the complement proteins interact with one another in a chain reaction. And at the end of that chain reaction, it can kill the bugs. It's like once you tip over one of a domino, you know, the rest of the dominoes all fall down. And same thing here. Once you irritate these proteins in the blood called complement, they go through their chain reaction, and at the end of the chain reaction, boom, they could kill the bugs. Next slide says, I would retitle it, how does complement kill? Of course, I have to make my slides sort of medically and technically more appropriate, so I didn't want to say how does complement kill, but you can write that here. Three ways bugs are killed by complement. Number one, and I'll animate it with a red rectangle. There it goes. Phagocytosis enhancement. In other words, complement calls out the phagocytes, the Pac-Man cells. The way it does, it's kind of cool. What complement does is physically complement will coat the bug, kind of like putting icing on a cake. And if you put icing on a cake, it looks really tasty to our Pac-Man cells, and they gobble them up. Way number two that complement kills is through inflammation. We'll see how inflammation works against microbes coming up shortly. Third way complement kills is by a process called cytolysis. I like the word. Lysis means to break apart. Cyto means cell. So we're going to bust apart bacterial cells. How? Through something called a membrane attack complex, abbreviated MAC. What literally happens is about five of the different complement proteins come together. They form a structure that's shaped almost like a dagger or a dart. And physically, that complex punches a hole in the bacterial cell membrane and pops it. I think of it like a Big Mac attack. So that's the third way complement kills. And you're thinking again, oh boy, lots to remember. There is. That's the deal in A&P. So I put this in order on purpose because I gave myself a little mnemonic. P-I-C, pick. How does the complement system pick apart bacteria? You'll say phagocytosis, inflammation, and cytolysis through a Big Mac attack. While you're making notes, maybe drawing pictures, I even like to draw a picture here of a dagger popping a cell on the board. But while you're doing that, you might be thinking, yeah, that's cool, but I'll never see that again. But you will. This is real stuff. There's a disease called lupus, and one of the blood tests for lupus is you will measure complement levels. It just so turns out that certain complement proteins will be low in your lupus patients. They get used up in the inflammatory process that the lupus patients experience. So yes, you will see this in the real world. What else we got to protect us that we're born with, quick at the ready? Inflammation. What is inflammation? Here's a definition. It's a response to tissue damage from what? Well, I listed a bunch of things. Microbes, physical agents, chemical agents, sunlight, ultraviolet light, acids, hammers. I mean, if I were you, I would write down inflammation is a response to tissue damage from anything. How do you know someone has inflammation? It's characterized by four cardinal signs and symptoms, and you better know them stone cold. They are redness, pain, heat, and swelling. Now, does inflammation always equal infection? I mean, if I walk across the room right now and I bang my knee on the table, wham, big red swollen knee. Is it inflamed? Yeah. Is it infected? No, sure isn't. Not right then, it's not anyway. So people with infection often have inflammation, but inflammation doesn't equal infection. Here's how it's important to know this. Let's say you're the nurse on the floor. Three people quit, two are on vacation, one's out on a break. You're going real fast. You think you got better things to do. You're out there pushing pills and so forth and checking EKGs. But in Mrs. Jones's room, you forget to take a look at her IV site. And around her IV, it's red, it's hot, it's painful, it's swollen. But you missed it. You come in the next day, she's in the ICU, you say, where's Mrs. Jones? And the person on the next shift said, oh, she got a really bad blood infection from an infected IV site. So you missed something big. You made a bad mistake. And everybody knows it. Look, the patient knows it was hurting there. Her family knows. The lawyer in the family knows. It all goes downhill from there. What are the three steps of inflammation? And please don't mix up these three steps with the four signs and symptoms that we just did, okay? The signs and symptoms are things that you or the patient can see and feel, okay? The steps of inflammation are totally different. These are sort of the biochemical pathways, the events that take place during the process of inflammation. Starting with number one, vasodilation and increased permeability. Uh-oh, those are big words, right? Vasodilation means blood vessels dilate. Increased permeability, in plain old English, means the blood vessels leak. So step number one of inflammation, vessels dilate and they leak. So what? Who cares? What's the purpose? You should write it down. The purpose is to bring all the goodies to the site of the tissue injury. T cells, neutrophils, macrophages, and clotting factors, and other goodies. Brings the goodies to the area. Step number two in inflammation is phagocyte emigration. Big words again. All that means is Pac-Man cells move. Which way do they move? They move to the site of the tissue injury. Look at this picture. If I take a dirty, cruddy knife and I slice my arm right here, how do those Pac-Man cells know to move to the site of the injury? I mean, after all, why don't they go this way, down to the left? Why don't they go this way, down to the right? They know where to go because of a process called chemotaxis. And I love that word. Chemo means chemical. And chemotaxis kind of sounds like chemical attraction. And that's exactly what happens. At the site of an injury, chemicals are laid down that attract the Pac-Man cells to the site of the injury. It's kind of like ants, right? Ants know how to find the food because they follow a trail of chemicals that are laid down. It's like a scent trail. So you want to think of it like a scent trail, that's cool. But know the technical terms. The third step of inflammation by definition is tissue repair. You might be wondering, how's all that stuff happen? I mean, How do all the steps and the signs and symptoms happen? Just because Dr. Gonchore said they happen? No, there are chemicals that regulate the process. They're known as the chemical mediators of inflammation. They're the chemical regulators of all those steps and signs and symptoms that we just talked about. Your book lists a whole bunch of them. I just want you to know three. I'm taking it easy on you. First one I want you to know is called histamines. Why do I pick on histamines? Think of the last time you had a cold. Red, runny, stuffy nose. What did you take? Yeah, you took an antihistamines. Next chemical I want you to know, big word called prostaglandins. Made by every cell in the human body except a red blood cell. You'll study them in great detail in pharmacology. The reason I want you to know this chemical is because last time you banged your knee, strained your shoulder, last time you had menstrual cramps, what did you take? We reached for a bottle of what's called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents. They call them NSAIDs. In other words, things like Motrin and aspirin, they are specifically designed to knock down prostaglandins, and that will knock down the inflammation and the swelling. The third chemical regulator of inflammation I want you to know is compliment. Our old friend, there it is, that's nothing new. Yep, we know that compliment stirs up inflammation and helps us get rid of the foreign invaders. Oh yeah, take a look at that picture. That is a pressure ulcer on a heel. It looks red, looks swollen. I bet it's warm to the touch. Probably hurts. Got some pus there. Looks like it's infected. So yeah, we're seeing some signs of inflammation there. By the way, what's one of the most common reasons people get pressure ulcers on their heel? Well, it's because the nurse didn't follow the order on the chart that says, please turn the patient, whatever, several times a day. Or walk the patient down the hallway three times a day. Or let them go sit in a chair three times a day. If you don't get the patient moving, the pressure literally clots off the capillaries to the tissue. No blood supply, no oxygen, tissue dies, and it leads to this. This can lead to worse things like amputations, and trust me, the patient knows that they weren't walking or sitting in their chair for days on end. The lawyer knows, and it all comes back to the nurse who made the big mistake. Before we leave inflammation, I want to see if you can connect the dots because it's just so important. We talked about the signs and symptoms. We talked about the steps and the chemical regulators. If you go back to this slide, and we try to hook it all together now, the increased permeability and the vasodilation that we talked about, what does that lead to that you see in your patients? Well, if you dilate blood vessels and you make them leak, doesn't that make the area red because you brought more blood? Doesn't it make it hot because you brought more blood? And doesn't it make it swollen because the vessels leaked? You see how this stuff comes together? That's how you should be hooking all this together. Get that big picture down, and it will really help you remember and retain this stuff and understand it, more importantly, long term. Finally, fever. What fever is? Yes, an elevation in body temperature. It occurs due to chemicals released due to infection or inflammation. Yeah, fever doesn't always mean infection. It often does. But those of you who have kids know, when they cut their teeth, right, they can get a low-grade fever. So chemicals are released, kind of readjust our thermostat, and our body raises the temperature. And do you as a healthcare provider automatically treat every single fever that you see? Of course not. There's a reason why we have limits that we use, because fever intensifies our defenses. It intensifies interferons. Fever can sometimes directly inhibit or kill certain bacteria, and it speeds up our metabolism, including our tissue repair. So no, we just don't smack down every fever that we see. Now look, before we end this unit, don't go home and say, hey, Dr. Gonshore said we don't treat fevers. I mean, if someone has a temperature of 105, and you don't do something about it, their brain is going to melt inside their skull. So you're going to learn when to treat the fever and when not to.